Hello, and welcome to Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. We're the boyfriends. I'm Billy Ray.
And I'm Joel.
And in today's episode, we're doing Season 7, Episode 21, Then I Really Got Scared.
Yes, we're very near the end now.
Yes, we are. So just as a tidbit before we start, we have had a very good weekend.
It's been very busy.
Yes, and for those of you who would be interested, which I assume you would be because you're listening to this podcast, we literally just saw Felicity Huffman in a stage play in London.
Called Here.
H-I-R. We had never heard of this play, and Felicity Huffman knocked it out of the park, as you'd expect.
To be fair, the entire cast knocked it out of the park, and to be by the time this episode comes out, it will be over. because I think it's only got a week run left. But if you saw it, then we hope you enjoyed it as well. It was uncomfortable and artistic and brilliant, and it was every single member of that cast were just phenomenal. The stage work, the lighting, the characterization, the writing, it was all so good.
Yeah, it was an acting masterclass basically, which you would expect, and I expected nothing less from Felicity, and she delivered that.
She did really deliver it, and everybody else that performed alongside her kept up.
Yeah,
they all kept up with her.
Felicity's a great actress.
Yeah.
And for anyone in the audience that we spoke to about our podcast, hopefully you're listening. Hello.
Hello. Yes, hello.
Although by the time you get to this episode, that's way in the past.
Yeah, yeah. You've probably forgotten all about it. But yeah, no, it was a wonderful show. And Felicity acknowledged our existence.
Oh, yeah. We got a little nod when we were clapping because we were in the front row.
Which was very close to the stage. Like, it was a very intimate theatre. Like, you couldn't walk past people on the front row. Like, if you had to get to the middle of the row, you would have had to have walked on the stage.
Yeah, there were moments where they were right in front of us. But we stood up, we clapped and cheered at the end, and we did get a little nod our way from Felicity.
Yeah, she looked us in the eye and nodded. It was cool. So,
yeah, that was lovely.
Yeah.
So, in today's episode, I'm going to be leading, and Joel is going to give us his trivia. So what do you have to start us off with?
Okay, so this episode was directed by Larry Shaw and written by Valerie Brodsky.
That's a new one.
I think it is a new one, yeah. So the episode aired on the 8th of May 2011. The title of this episode is inspired by lyrics taken from the song I Know Things Now from the Stephen Sondheim musical Into the Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an IMDb review. There's a few IMDb reviews for this episode. It's about this. At the point of recording, there are three. Two of them slagging off Lynette. One of them slagging off everybody else for slagging off Lynette. but one of them, just who was from Michael20, and that is Michael, I didn't stutter. It was Michael20. He said, "Dear Lord Lynette, give Tom a chance to make some decisions. I've never seen, on TV or in real life, a woman who is such a control freak and puts down her husband on a daily basis. Tom should have been awarded with the Medal of Honor for living with her for 20 years. She is such a controlling bee, bad mother and horrible human being. Run away, Tom, run."
I thoroughly disagree.
I completely disagree.
Because Tom gets as good as he gives. And to be honest, with this particular story, I have mixed feelings on both of them.
Yeah.
So to solely blame Lynette is very shocking to me.
Yeah.
Except I suppose we shouldn't be shocked, as that was written by a man.
So. And I mean, I was very much on Lynette's side up until towards the end when we got a bit more about Tom's perspective on the situation, and then it did give me a bit of a shift, and I ceased being just on Lynette's side, and I moved more towards a "you're kind of as bad as each other" kind of mentality. But we'll get there. So Lynette and Tom in this episode have a bit of an argument about Holiday, and Lynette she does some shady dealings in the way that she tries to convince the kids about her holiday by, instead of trying to convince the kids about her holiday and leaving it at that, she kind of shits on Tom's idea as well by trying to make the kids scared about various different factors. So one of them being shark attacks. So I did some research
in Hawaii
on shark attacks, just in general, these shark attacks, not just Hawaii, because I can't imagine that Hawaiian sharks are too vastly different from the Australian kind or whatever, the Californian kind, who knows. But when you look at the numbers, sharks are actually the ones that should really in theory be making horror films about us, because experts have said that humans kill an estimated 100 million sharks a year, while the average number of human fatalities from sharks is around 5 in a year, or one sort of every 2 years in the US.
Yeah, the way that we treat sharks is disgusting.
Yeah. And the odds of being killed by a shark currently are 1 in 3.7 million. Things that are likely to kill you more than a shark attack. A champagne cork.
A champagne cork.
24 people a year are estimated to die from that, and that is just in France.
Sorry, but literally how?
Constipation.
What? Kill you?
Yep. Falling. They say 1 in 98 people will have a fall that is fatal.
I'm 98 of those people.
Yeah, you are. Fireworks. 8 a year.
Yep, human stupidity.
Yep. A lawnmower. They say 1 in 70 people are killed by a lawnmower. Lightning strikes. 20 a year, they estimate, are killed by lightning strikes. Tanning beds, although not like in Final Destination 3.
I was going to say, I don't want to think about that.
I think that's more connected to skin cancer. And tornadoes.
Damn.
Those are all things that are more likely to kill you than a shark. What I'm saying is, there really is no need to fear sharks. And if Lara Croft can punch one in the nose...
Which apparently is doable.
Yeah.
From researching that film.
And finally, she also talks about helicopter crashes. And it's difficult to kind of get an average rate of deaths for helicopter crashes because it's not done in a normal way. So the way that they rate the fatalities of helicopter crashes is they calculate it per 100,000 flight hours.
Okay, I don't understand the point of doing it that way. Yeah, but
they rate 1.3 deaths per 100,000 flight hours. Now, I don't get how we get 1.3.
Okay.
So again, helicopters, really not that likely to kill you.
Mm, yeah.
Very, very unlikely. Although obviously Kobe Bryant being probably the most recent one.
Yeah.
Anyway, this week, what happened this week? Thousands of people gather at Ground Zero at the September 11 attacks in New York to celebrate the news that Osama bin Laden had been killed.
Mm-hmm.
Oil prices fall following the news that US forces have killed Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. This week's news was completely overrun with Osama bin Laden and the fallout of his death.
I had a feeling that was going to come after my trivia last week.
Yeah. So the United Nations projects that the world's population will pass 7 billion on October 31st, 2011. And I did a little bit of extra research. And as of Friday the 8th of March, so 2 days prior to us recording... The current global population is 8.1 billion.
So they could have been right.
Yeah, they could have been right. Mm. Daniel Barenboim, a conductor and pianist and supporter of Palestinian rights, holds a peace concert in the Gaza Strip.
Fierce.
During a visit to the United Kingdom, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, sure how to pronounce it, is the biggest threat to world peace now that Osama bin Laden has been killed.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Let's just marinate on that for a second.
I mean, I don't think Donald Trump helped very much when he was president on world peace, to be honest.
No, but considering Benjamin Netanyahu is Benjamin Netanyahu, that's quite a kettle calling the pot black. There is a near riot in the Beijing Apple store as the Apple iPad 2 goes on sale in the People's Republic of China.
Yeah, I feel like as a human race, we still haven't figured out a good way to control crowds when it comes to opening stores and like Black Friday and sales and stuff. And
yeah.
It's just bonkers.
Anyway, so that's everything that happened that week. So the number one song in the US was E.T. by Katy Perry, featuring Kanye West. Yep. And the number one song in the UK was still Party Rock Anthem.
Damn, that's disappointing.
Now, the top movie for both the US and the UK was Thor.
The first one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Other than that, that is all my trivia.
Lovely. Very good. So, previously, Brie met Detective Chuck Vance and there was flirtation, chemistry, if you will. Lynette and Tom's marriage continues to be tested with disagreements and misunderstanding. And Paul misunderstood Susan's intentions and kicked her out of his home and then collapsed to the floor, most likely due to poisoning because of Felicia Tillman.
Paul misunderstanding Susan for something? I can't imagine that ever happening ever again.
Yeah. Misunderstanding in the Susan story. Bonkers, yeah, right? So we're going to start with Brie. So Detective Chuck Vance runs into Brie on her way out and hands her another card, sure that she lost the last one as she hasn't called him yet, but she insists that she didn't, which was a little shady.
Yeah, I know, right?
They have a little more flirtation, followed by Chuck telling her that he's trying to court her, his words, not mine, and Brie gives in, setting a date for next Thursday.
He does... make a very valid point in this scene in saying that if he continues, it does get a bit stalky.
Yeah, I have to say, for the start of their relationship, I do like the chemistry and the banter.
I hate him so much, but him and Brie, they go very well together at the beginning. Like, they're so fun to watch.
They are. And I can't tell you how upsetting the turn was.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Yeah.
But I just love the shadiness of her being like, no, I didn't lose it.
No, I didn't lose it.
She's just like, no, I just didn't want to call you.
Yeah.
Even though she totally did.
She absolutely did.
She loves being chased.
Now, do you believe that she was genuinely going to leave?
No.
Because she came out of the house and said, oh, I was just on my way out. And then she turned to go back in after her conversation with Chuck. But obviously he is a detective, which means you can't hide shit from him.
I think she knew he was there.
Okay.
I think she was flirting.
Yeah.
What about you?
I don't know. I kind of feel like...
Bree's not very forgetful.
She's not very forgetful, but in this instance with like the flirting and the banter, I wouldn't be too surprised if she did kind of lose her bearings a bit and then go back inside or go back inside. I don't think it's like Bree to be standing there and watching and seeing someone pull up to her house and then be like, oh, I'm going to look busy now. That just doesn't feel like Bree.
No, I guess we'll never know.
Yeah.
Later, Renee comes over to invite Bree out, but she says that she can't as she has a date, which Renee thinks is Bree making stuff up to get out of hanging out with her, which is hilarious and kind of rude.
Mm.
They talk about Chuck, except all she can say is his name and occupation, and Renee tells Bree that she's going to need to find out everything there is to know about the guy.
Bree is so naive, and thank God she has Renee here to help her out.
Well, I disagree, because that's the point of the date. To find out more.
Yeah, but Renee makes a very valid point in that, you know, she needs to check their medical history and stuff like that. Otherwise, you could end up like Renee and be stuck under a dead linebacker or whatever she said.
Yeah, that was weird.
That was really weird.
I don't know what she's on about.
But
so it's date night, but Renee has come over before Chuck so that she can give Bree her findings, her sleuthings, saying that she would be very interested in page 3 in particular. So Bree has a look and finds... To her horror, well, we don't know, because Bree doesn't read it to us, so we have no idea.
No.
And then Chuck rings the bell, and so they go off to their date.
Bree is quite concerning in this scene, because when Renee won't tell Bree what it is, and she's like, you should just read it, I think you'll be interested in page 3. Actually, Renee's like, his salary alone for me makes him a non-starter. But Bree seems more concerned about the fact that he could possibly be a Democrat than a dirty cop.
Well, that's Bree for you.
Like, and that in itself is so concerning. Like, this girl needs to sort out her priorities.
So Bree and Chuck are at the restaurant, and Bree's trying to get Chuck to open up, clearly wanting to hear something in particular. He mentions his past marriage, his degree, and his 2 kids, but Bree wants to know if he was going to tell her that he's still married. Did the 2 kids ever come up again?
I've written it down that they're never mentioned again. And until this moment where I watched the episode, I completely forgot he even had kids.
Oh, okay.
I'm so sure they are not mentioned again.
Okay, good to know. So he tells her that his divorce is going through, even though it's not finished. And Bree thinks that he shouldn't really be dating until it does go through. And that he should have told her and should have opened with that. And he retaliates by bringing up Bree's past husband and that she... didn't mention him. This is Orson, the hit and run driver, as well as the pharmacist that killed himself while they were dating. So they've both done their research, and Bree doesn't appreciate it at all, and she leaves.
Yeah, the hypocrisy of Bree in this scene, really.
The absolute hypocrisy.
It was nice to get a little George throwback, though.
Oh, I love a George throwback.
Like, oh my God, George Williams. Jesus, that was season 2.
Still my favourite villain.
So was the hit and run as well. George and Orson's hit and run of Mike, both season 2, which is wild.
What a crazy past Bree's had.
Yeah.
So Chuck is driving Bree home, and since she tells him that he doesn't have a chance with her, he decides to take the moment to do a little bit of police work and pulls up behind a man trying to solicit some sex work. He pulls out his badge and tells the guy to drive off, so he leaves. And then Chuck himself picks up the sex worker.
Violet.
Is that her name?
Violet, yeah.
Thank you, because I didn't hear it mentioned, and I was like, I'm just going to have to keep referring to her as the sex worker. How sad.
No, you said, get in, Violet.
Surprisingly, he isn't taking her to jail, but he's actually taking her to a woman's shelter, which she is very unappreciative of. At the women's shelter, she tells Chuck that she'll be right back tomorrow, and so Chuck makes up a story that Bree was once on the street, but went to school and turned herself around, which she clearly doesn't appreciate at first, but then she sees that maybe this could actually help, and she does play along a bit.
Yeah.
So eventually she plays along, and this seems to inspire the girl. Chuck then takes Bree home.
You completely glossed over the fact that that sex worker read Bree to filth.
Well, I just want you to stick to the facts that pertain to the case, as Lynette Scarver once said.
She was like, oh... You're better off without a Chuck. This one's got a stick up her ass. Like,
and then
great.
Bree's just like, I'm not going to be insulted by a sex worker.
Red to filth. And you know what? Good for you, Violet, because Bree was being a judgy bitch.
A judgy Republican biatch.
Yeah.
So the next day, Bree visits Chuck at the police office and tells him of her confused feelings about the previous night, and, you know, fair enough, it was kind of wild, saying that she was offended by not being told about his marriage, but she was touched by his actions with Violet. She then admits how unfair she was to expect things from him when she was also withholding of information. They bond over how complicated dating is, and how they both have their walls up because of past experiences. He then suggests that they forget about the crazy digging that they did, and they have another first date. And then he takes her out to an Indian restaurant.
How do you know I like Indian food?
I have to say, it is a bit dodge to use your position in the police force to look up someone's record, and I'm pretty sure it is not allowed.
I'm pretty sure it's not allowed, no. It's red flag number one.
Yeah.
But it's such a subtle red flag that you kind of brush it off, because at the same time, Bree researched Chuck, so from an audience perspective, we're like, oh, okay, well, they're as bad as each other, like, ha ha ha.
Yeah, it's a subtle red flag because it's used for comedy, but when you think about it, abusing your position to look up someone's record versus what the kids these days would call, well, not the kids these days, the kids in our day would call Facebook stalking.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I put that story first because it's another story of Bree dating someone, which we have had this season.
Yeah.
So to me, it was the least interesting, even though I like Chuck.
Yeah.
Now let's move on to Gabby. For some reason, Gabby is watching a horror film with Juanita. That sentence alone.
Yeah, she's going to regret letting Juanita watch a film about the hash-slinging slasher.
Carlos comes in and he is horrified by this situation and tells Gabby that this is unacceptable. But she says it's a good life lesson for Juanita, as it's completely unrealistic anyway. With Juanita confirming this, saying, there's no way that a spear gun can shoot through 3 heads in real life.
Right, 2 tops.
Gabby thinks that Juanita will be fine, but we cut to a bit later on in the night and Juanita runs into Gabby and Carlos's room, scared of being killed by the axe murderer.
Yeah, the axe murderer that she sees outside. And then she's like, Carlos is like, fine, you sleep. I'm going to sleep in your bed. And she's like, Celia's in my bed.
Yeah.
And then he's like, fine, I'll sleep in Celia's bed. Well, Celia wet her bed. And I don't believe for a second that Celia wet her bed. I reckon Celia went into Juanita's bed. Juanita poured water on Celia's bed so that the bed was wet, so that Carlos would have to stay in bed with them because she would feel more safe with Carlos there as well.
Yeah, and I'm not saying right now that Juanita is a dumb child or anything like that. I'm just saying this is the second time in only a couple of episodes where they have completely overestimated Juanita's maturity. Mm-hmm. Level. They thought that she could handle this really adult news of Bree and what happened with Juanita Solis Sr.
Yeah, her grandmother.
And now they're overestimating how she can take horror movies that are aimed for a much older audience.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, kids develop at different ages, and I certainly developed at a young age so that I could watch horror movies.
Mm.
But Juanita is not that girl.
No, she's not. I didn't develop about horror movies until I was quite a bit older. I did not like horror movies as a child.
Exactly. So this was pretty poor from Gabby.
Poor parenting, I would say.
So Gabby has Lee over for some tea and they talk about Juanita's nightmares, with Lee saying about how he had horrible nightmares as a child too. So Gabby grabs Juanita so that Lee can give one of those inspirational speeches that the gays love to give so much. Thanks, Gabby.
We do love an It Gets Better speech. We do. But Lee, I'm sorry, is not the right person to give it.
Well, apparently not. He tells her about how he had nightmares too, and then follows up with a story about inmates from a mental institution breaking out and kidnapping children. So clearly Lee didn't understand the assignment and he just scared her more. And he obviously clearly just recently watched Halloween.
In a ravine. Alive!
Carlos comes home to find Gabby trying to set up a tent and doing a really horrible job. She says that she's doing it to try and prove that there isn't a scary guy outside the house at night. Carlos thinks the idea is laughable, and Gabby says that Carlos is going to be out here with her, but he then tells her no and that she caused this problem so she can sleep outside with Juanita, and you know what? Yeah, fair.
I just think it's weird that they're not camping in the back garden.
I do too. I thought it was a really strange idea to do it on the front lawn.
I mean, I know it's probably because Juanita has seen the person out the front, and so it's like, there is nobody there. It's just people walking past and blah, blah, blah. But even then, it's weird for me to see people camping out on a front garden, especially when we know you've got a back. We know you've got a back garden. You do not have a house like that without a back garden, girl.
Exactly.
It was a bit weird.
I'm on Carlos's side, though. I'd be like, no, you can sleep up there with her.
Absolutely.
Right? She, like, does the worst things, and she's like, well, Carlos will sort it.
It's fun to sleep outside. No, that's what Carlos said to Gabby. He's like, it's fun to sleep outside. Fuck off. Fun to sleep outside. You wouldn't catch me dead sleeping outside.
Yeah, different kinds of people.
Yeah.
I think it's fun to sleep outside.
Mm-mm-mm.
So Gabby and Juanita are in the tent, and Juanita is refusing to remove the helmet that she's wearing for protection. This moment is almost like the US Office in terms of its comedy, when she tells her to take it off and then the camera does this quick pan to Juanita. It's like a very comedic shot.
It was a very comedic shot, and kind of unlike anything we've really had in Desperate Housewives before, so it was a little bit odd.
Yeah, it really stood out. I liked it.
Yeah.
She then sees a shadow behind Gabby on the tent, but Gabby says it's just people walking by, but the shadow just sort of lingers.
Yeah, I know.
And then
right?
We see the outline of an axe. So they both scream in terror as this axe-wielding stranger opens the tent holding the axe, but it turns out to just be Lee, again, trying to scare them. Gabby screams at him, but he says that he's just trying to help, with Juanita laughing at the face that Gabby was pulling, and then Lee says that just because something looks scary, it doesn't mean it is.
But to me, that's a load of crap. Like, it's all well and good, but Juanita already knows it's all fake. We've established that when she watched the film, she knew it was fake, and not to be panicked or paranoid about it. So you're just reiterating the same thing. We've already told this girl once, and surely if it's gone one ear and out the other before, it's just going to go in one ear and out the other again.
No, of course. I think the difference was that this moment had more of a... It was more of a cathartic moment. They had the build-up of tension, but then the laughter and the release at the end, which you don't always get with a horror film.
Yeah.
Later that night, there is another creepy shadow on the tent. This one is of a man with a hat, which really resembles the silhouette of Freddy Krueger.
It does.
Gabby thinks that this is Lee again and tells him to bugger off, in more American terminology.
Rude, because Lee would never be caught dead wearing a hat like that.
No, I do not think. But we cut to a shot from outside of the tent to see that it wasn't Lee. It was someone else. Someone that we haven't seen before.
No, who is it?
Which is a bit creepy.
It is real creepy, actually.
And then during the ending montage, Mary Alice talks about things that go bump in the night, and we finish on a shot of a man in the hat from last night staring up at Gabby's place, and Mary Alice ends saying, the answer is sometimes yes.
What's the answer to sometimes yes?
About things going bump in the night. Sometimes things do go bump in the night.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
I didn't make that very clear.
You really didn't make that clear. You just said she talks about things that go bump in the night. And then she said yes.
Well, it's just because I was just writing exactly what Mary Alice said. But yeah. It just made more sense in context.
Now, see, if Mary Alice chats, I normally just go, Mary Alice says something about this. And then we see all of this.
Yeah, Mary Alice is chatting again, guys.
She's talking shit again from up on a cloud. High and mighty Mary Alice. Over here.
Either way, Mary Alice is basically saying sometimes there are creeps out at night.
Yeah.
There are creeps out there.
Sometimes there are pervs that are watching you, and that's okay.
She doesn't say that's okay. But yeah, I don't know who this guy is, but clearly they're setting something up.
Yeah. Let him
something
watch.
Something horrifying. Now let's talk about Lynette's story. Everyone is having dinner in the Scarvo household, and Tom makes it home just in time, unenthusiastic about taco night. He then hands out plane tickets and mentions that he booked a family holiday in Hawaii, which Lynette is very unhappy about, as she had no say in this, having planned the family holiday already, which she's apparently done for the past 16 years. The kids, however, are extremely excited, so Lynette again looks like the bad guy.
Yeah.
Which is very similar to a past episode where Lynette has said, I always look like the bad guy.
Yeah.
Because he swoops in with a fun thing, which they haven't discussed, and now she's the bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Or the boring one, because holiday is boring in comparison to Hawaii, first class tickets,
yeah,
and all that.
So I'm very sorry, Michael, but I'm on Lynette's side right now.
Yeah.
She just said, I've done it for the past 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell, Tom?
Why not just talk to her about it? Like, Tom is really gross in this scene because, one, you talk about it with your wife first. Like, it's all very well and good, like, to say, oh, I did it as a surprise to you. That's bullshit. I'm sorry. I can't stand it when something like this happens and then the other person's like, oh, but it was supposed to be a surprise. No, you're saying that as a get out. You're saying that as a get out clause.
The surprise would be, don't book the holiday. I'm not going to tell you why, yeah. But I've got a surprise.
However, from the sounds of it, in this scene, they'd already spoken about the holiday.
Yeah.
From because Lynette doing saying, it, not Tom doing it.
Saying we're going to Hawaii is still a surprise. Even if you know there's a surprise coming, the surprise is surprising.
It's yeah.
Like, come on.
But then Lynette obviously mentions her sister and like, oh, well, I have plans. We're going to stop and see our sister. And Tom just says, like, we fly her out to us. Like, we go to Hawaii, we have a holiday, we come back, we fly her out to us. Like, people aren't at your beck and call. Like, you can't just rearrange plans and expect everyone involved to move around like your puppets.
Yeah, but now he's got big manager boss energy. Yeah, and he's so like, everyone will work around me.
I can tell Lynette's sister to just work around me.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah. So Tom comes to bed and tries to kiss Lynette, but she tells him he's wasting his time like she did when planning the road trip. Tom then says the worst thing I've ever heard and tells her that her road trip just isn't going to work out this year, but that she gave it a... she has a hell of a start on next year's trip, which obviously doesn't go down well.
No, because Lynette calls him out on his BS management tactic.
The compliment sandwich.
Yeah.
Which she taught Tom in the first place because she's a better business person than him.
Yes, she is. He also says, I already promised Hawaii to the kids. That sounds like a you problem. Like, you should be now the one to go and tell the kids that you promised them something that you shouldn't have promised.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You're also letting down the auntie.
Yeah, that sounds like a YP, not an MP.
And then says that with the same budget, she'd make an even better trip, which Tom doesn't believe. So they decide to compete, and then they can pitch their holidays to the kids as a deciding factor.
Yeah.
Which I think is a fabulous idea, but I also think for them and the situation they're in is a terrible idea.
Oh, it's a terrible idea. It won't go down well. However, I do also think it's fun.
In terms of, like, if this was a regular family, I think it'd be a fun idea.
Well, it'd be a real fun idea for a functional family, but this is dysfunctional.
Not when they're both annoyed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Lynette is giving her presentation to the kids, but none of them seem overly enthusiastic by the Grand Canyon or a national forest, joking about the idea of spending their holiday looking at trees and a hole in the ground, with Tom telling them to be nice.
This scene always sticks with me.
And then Lynette, ever the businesswoman, sees the reaction that she's getting, which might have actually been planned, and changes tactics to her next idea, which was probably her main idea, the Screaminator.
Well, I think it's all one idea. They're taking an RV, so I think it's like, we hit this thing, we hit this, and then we hit this. I think she was doing a build-up. She knew the kids wouldn't be too impressed with the forest and the Grand Canyon, but it's like, lower their expectations so that you can hit them again with a good thing.
Yeah, she's a businesswoman.
She's a businesswoman.
She knows what she's doing.
She does, she does. She even says, like, when she mentions the Screaminator, I think it's in the... Oh, we don't have a clip.
Yeah, we don't have a clip.
I think she even says, Responsible Parent Magazine calls it the worst thing since the caffeinated jukebox. Now, that's a hell of a lot of things to hear in one sentence.
It really is.
And I did try and Google caffeinated juice box to see if that was legitimately a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
But all that kept coming up was Five Alive. Do you remember Five Alive?
No.
Do you not remember Five Alive? Oh my God, Five Alive was great. It was a juice. It was so good. But then I did research Responsible Parent Magazine.
Please tell me it's not real.
It's real.
Responsible Parent Magazine. Yeah. Subscription service.
The Silver Zone Group is presenting a new monthly magazine, Responsible Parenting, to strengthen knowledge and confidence levels in parents to communicate effectively with their children. The magazine aims to equip parents with such key skills that they can use to encourage positive behaviors in their children, creating space, yet fostering information exchange, networking, and support. And apparently you can read more about it at a website called Magster. M-A-G-Z-T-E-R. Magster.
This just sounds like some white American conservative nonsense.
$9.99 a month or £99.99 for a year's subscription.
999p.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
You can get Responsible Parenting Magazine. And it's I had like a brief read of the bio and it seemed to talk about helping parents navigate how to raise children to be responsible in a kind of environment which they were not raised in, you know, mm-hmm. like a more modern day environment. Kids have so much more distractions and so much more that can keep them sort of occupied nowadays than kids from their generation and that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to read that.
No, I won't read that either. But
like I said, it just sounds like white American conservative nonsense.
But it exists.
Yeah, if that's your thing, go nuts. Mm-hmm. So she talks about the Screaminator, which is this very exciting ride that parents hate and the kids are really on board with. Now, as a bit of a nerd, I like the sound of the hole in the ground and the trees. over the Screaminator, which to me sounds terrifying. That's just my point of view.
I really like theme parks, so I would do the Screaminator. However, I also, as someone that has never been to America, would very much love to go see the Grand Canyon and very much love to go see that national park.
Yeah.
And everything that America has to offer, because it's just so massive. But yeah, even after all of that, I do think I would still pick Hawaii.
I've always wanted to
go to Hawaii.
Yeah, I'd do Hawaii. So Tom mentions the RV and how it might not be suitable for Paige. So Lynette then reveals the next big thing, the road juggernaut. A bigger, better RV with baths, technology, and 6 sleeping compartments. And apparently Justin Bieber used it to make water balloons.
Shut up!
And the kids are well excited.
Yeah, they seem to love the road juggernaut.
Well, yeah, it's got tech, it's got rooms, it's got baths. Cool.
Yeah, it's not your average poor person's RV now, which is probably what Lynette was originally looking at.
I just love the idea of a road trip from watching those American road trip movies.
I would love to be able to jump in an RV and just like drive around the country for a little bit and see everything the country has to offer. I would absolutely love that. I think that would be really cool. Maybe not so much England. Maybe I'd take an RV and travel around Europe a bit.
A bit later, we then see Tom pitching his ideas for a holiday in Hawaii. And it's pretty great, not gonna lie. And the kids are all on board.
Right, they've all got that, what's that thing? The flowers that go around the neck.
Yeah, the flowery thing.
The flower thing.
The necklace thing.
Yeah, I can't remember what it's called. It's got a technical term, I don't remember it. And in the background, obviously, they've got the TV that they've been doing the presentation on, like each of them. And it's got a picture of people surfing, and every single one of the person has one of the Scavo kids' faces superimposed on their bodies, and one of them is just Paige on a surfboard.
Yeah, a little bit of Photoshop goes a long way for these kids. So Lynette can see that she's losing the battle, so she resorts to the common internet fool's favourite trick in the book, misinformation, with a pinch of conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
She warns the kids of the sharks that could be infesting the waters, with reports of attacks likely being covered up.
Did she and claim then, about attacks being covered up?
She did.
Oh.
She claimed they could be covered up. So you've got misinformation and you've got conspiracy theory. Yeah. Love that. Love it. As well as helicopter crashes. And she shows a picture of, you can imagine, it's horrible.
It's just a helicopter crash, yeah.
What the fuck?
Picture of a helicopter crash.
The kids then decide to leave to discuss their options before they vote, which was a very sort of adulty, funny thing that I liked.
Yeah, and Tom put an end to it. He literally stopped Lynette in her tracks with that BS. He was like, not today, Lynette, and like stopped it. Because he was like, oh, okay, you want to talk about crashes? How many people die in a car crash?
Yeah.
And you want to take our entire family on the road in an RV, you psychopath.
Like, this is the part of the episode where I was like, Lynette's going too far.
Yeah, I think Lynette took it a tad too far at this part of the episode. However, it's the next Tom and Lynette scene that I was on about.
Tom calls Lynette a hypocrite, clearly unhappy about the situation, relating this back to the Christmas 10 years ago when Lynette said that when Tom makes the big money, he gets to make the decisions. But Lynette says that they're supposed to be equal partners.
And that is the moment where I shifted from being on Lynette's side.
I still didn't. I was like, she's been doing it for 16 years. It's just the common thing. If you want to bring this thing up from 10 years ago and take over now that you're making the big money so it's fair, bring it up.
No, but it was the fact that she basically said, I make the big bucks, so I make the big decisions. And when you make the big bucks, you can make the big decisions. And something like that from 10 years, like that in itself is so emasculating. Mm-hmm. For you to just be like, I make the big bucks, sit back down, little boy. Like that's basically what she was doing.
Yeah, that was a crazy thing to hear. And I was like, wow, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
But I do still think if it was 10 years ago and people change, why are you holding on to it anyway? Just say that you wanted to take over the holiday this year. But this new information does make me feel a bit more on the fence about it.
That's why I was like, I'm no longer on Lynette's side anymore. They're both as bad as each other, like, honest to God.
So, they carry on arguing, and he calls her a control freak, which she kind of is. She calls him a pompous ass, and then he calls her a raging bitch, which Penny sees and hears from the stairs, and she runs upstairs crying.
This scene really sticks with me, and I think it's just because it's so well acted between the two of them.
It was such an intense build-up.
It really was, and like, it's all coming out, like, every single thing that they've just withheld with each other, just bit by bit, has all just started to come sprawling out against, like, the wall.
Yeah, and Tom does definitely have things to be annoyed about, which I completely understand, because she is controlling. Mm. She's... Well, I guess that's the main issue. She's so controlling, but obviously we know what Tom's like.
Yeah.
So it's a lot.
Tom talks about success in this scene, but let's not forget, he wouldn't have this job if it wasn't for Lynette. Like, he would still be working for Carlos, getting paid like shit, if it wasn't for Lynette putting like her foot down and getting involved, which I guess in a certain extent you could also call controlling, because it is controlling. Tom made a decision about his career and she should have been happy with that. However, for him to then sit there and be like, oh, I'm more successful than you'll ever be. If I was Lynette, I'd be like, yeah, no thanks to me.
Right. Also, I don't think so. If Lynette didn't have to quit, if she didn't have to keep taking time out of jobs and stuff, I'm pretty sure she'd be very high up.
Right, how far would she be in her career right now if she didn't stop?
Because we've literally just spoken about how she taught him this compliment sandwich.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Whatever, Tom. So Lynette tells Tom that she spoke to Penny, and she says that she doesn't want to have to choose between them, which he thinks she means as in, like, holiday-wise, but she actually means which one of them to live with, thinking that they're going to be getting a divorce. And Lynette actually mentions here how Penny's friends' parents have all gotten divorced so far, so it isn't that far-fetched. And they talk about how they've never argued like that before. Unfortunately, it continues as Tom says he can't open his mouth without getting his head bitten off. But he also admits that even at home, he still thinks of the office. So Lynette says that maybe they need a holiday together, just the two of them alone, to sort stuff out.
Yeah, like a weekend away.
And they decide to do it this weekend. And Lynette kind of also gets a bit annoyed when Tom says that he has to check with work. So it just kind of ends on what feels like it could be a hopeful note, but it's also awkward and sad.
Yeah, it ends really awkwardly. Like, this scene really irritates me on both parts. Lynette, because he's a CEO, so he can't just up and leave. Like, he will need to check with the office, and you can't get shitty with him for saying, I just need to check with the office.
Yeah, like, I think it's just because he said about how he still thinks of the office at home, so she's like, oh, the office again.
Yeah, but at the same time, it also really, Tom really aggravated me in this scene, because he turns to Lynette and he's like, this has to stop. Like, we can't keep going like this. You're awful. Which yeah. is basically what he said. He was like, this has to stop. We can't keep going like this. And Lynette's like, I agree. And then he goes, I can't even open my mouth without you taking my head off. I'm like, Tom, you literally just said this has to stop. And then you poke the bear.
Yeah.
Like, and then there's a pause. Lynette calls him out for being a dick with what he just said. And then he's like, okay, I'm no better.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Like, we need to be nicer to each other, bitch.
Like, that's literally what it felt like.
Tensions are high, like, and this has been building.
Why be a dick and essentially say Lynette is wrong just for you to piss her off and get a reaction? Like, that's all you did. You did it for a reaction.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's move on to Susan and Paul's story. So, the opening of the show starts with Susan being used somewhat as a doormat, as she's very kind and polite, but people seem to take advantage of it. And we have a montage of different things, such as her holding the door open for someone, but then an entire group of people keep letting themselves in right after.
It's really annoying.
It is. It's annoying to watch. She gets harassed by a mime for money.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious. And then she finds someone's dog, which is, I guess, just to show her being nice.
It's like, oh my god, I'm so good. I'll do anything for anyone. I'm so perfect. But here's people, some magazines and some water pool. Like, here you go.
But yeah, she's being taken advantage of in these flashbacks. We then see her visit Paul in hospital, who tells her of his chest pains and that they're running tests to figure out what's up. He apologizes for yelling at her and kicking her out of the house, and she apologizes for the whole thing too, because she admits that she might have seemed a bit like a vulture.
Mm.
She then leaves him and the doctors to talk, and he confirms that it wasn't a heart attack, but most likely stress. But he does mention a previous patient who was showing the same sort of symptoms, and it was from being slowly poisoned by his wife, and Paul obviously thinks Susan is now poisoning him.
Yeah, like, it's Paul's an icon. Like, the minute he gets even an inkling of doubt about anyone, he jumps straight to revenge. You can really see it in his eyes. The minute the guy's like, oh yeah, it could be, you know, poison, a bit of antifreeze in the husband's oatmeal every day or whatever. And then Paul's like,
It's also kind of fucked up that anything happens and he'll instantly go to, like, the worst scenario in his head. He's like, this person's trying to kill me.
Yeah, I know. What the hell?
The doctor's like, it's probably stress. And he's like, she's trying to kill me. She's trying to kill me. But in all fairness, someone did shoot him in the same season, so I get why he's a bit on edge.
Yeah, and Susan is very trigger happy.
Yeah.
Shoot her.
So Susan is running through the school to try and catch up with Principal Hobson, who is walking away and pretending not to hear her. But of course, she does catch up, so he can no longer pretend.
Yeah, this poor principal just wants to avoid her, but she's like a mosquito.
She asks if he saw her email, followed by Hobson telling her he'd be glad to give her job back, but that it's not going to happen, saying that there are consequences to being a sex worker on the internet. He tells her about the parents' council and that how they have all the power in these situations, so Susan is off on a mission of redemption.
Winning over a parent council for a private school should be easy. Like white women dancing in her underwear, as long as she isn't a drag queen or trans person, I'm sure they won't see a problem in bringing her back. Half of the dads of the parents in this school have probably taken their kids to Hooters a dozen times anyway.
Yeah, I know. It's a very... This whole parents' council thing is a bit nuts, isn't it?
Yeah. And Principal Hobson's comic timing in this scene was just magnificent. It was like a chef's kiss. When Susan's like, did you read my emails? I sent you like 10. And he's like, no. And so she goes, oh, okay, so the first one. Okay, I read them.
Yeah.
Straight away. Instant. It was such great comic timing.
It's always funny to see someone that isn't one of the main characters and how they interact with Susan. And he's just trying to run away.
Yeah.
Which I love.
Which, it's a mood. Frankly.
Now, I've interspersed Susan's story with the same bits and pieces that happen in Paul's story. So following this, Paul takes out some leftover casserole that Susan made him, and he takes it to a scientist to test for antifreeze.
Yeah, and the scientist is like, huh, you want me to test the tuna noodle casserole?
And he's like, yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah, I do.
I like that you say you've interspersed Paul's scenes with Susan's scenes, but I've written nothing about Paul's scenes because there is literally nothing to say.
Yeah.
They're like the shortest scenes ever, and it's Paul talking to a scientist about food. Like,
yeah, so that happened.
Yeah.
Later, Susan wanders her way into the parent meeting thing where they're planning an open house event. It's very awkward, as clearly these nasty women are judging Susan as they won't let her sit down. And the head of the meeting keeps jabbing these little digs. She just keeps going. Need to work on that.
Susan's being treated like Forrest Gump when she walks into the school. Like when Forrest Gump walks onto the school bus and he goes to all the seats and all the kids are like, seats taken.
Yeah.
And that's literally what it feels like with Susan, where they just keep putting the stuff down on the seat so she can't sit next to them.
I really hate seeing adults do it in TV and film because I'm like, Jesus, you cannot let school go. You peaked. You literally put your bag down on the school bus and you were like, oh, I've peaked. This is what I'm doing for the rest of my life. Like, fucking hell.
And also, I find it hard to believe that any adult would genuinely behave like that.
I know. But, oh my God, honestly, white American conservative women, when they're judgy.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
You guys are all judgy.
Susan takes this moment to stand up and explain how crappy her family's year was and that she was a good teacher, and she asks them to allow her back in the school to teach. She wants to do something for the open house as a chance at redemption, so they give her the job of picking up the streamers. There isn't much else, so she has to accept.
I try not to confuse them with tassels.
Yeah, but she is mostly taken in good humour.
Yeah, she does. She does take it in good humour. And to be fair, credit to Susan, because she gets up on that stage and she's like, yeah, all right, you know what? Let's hash it out. Like,
yeah.
I did this. This was why. I had a really shit year. I had to do things I'm not proud of, but I was a good teacher. Like, credit to her for just getting up there and saying, bitch, you need me. I've seen the way that the teachers that are here now are teaching your kids, and they ain't going to amount to shit.
Yeah, and can we talk about the actual problem, the elephant in the room, so to speak? Yeah. If the teachers were getting paid properly for their work, she wouldn't need to be doing sex work online.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
Like, let's face it, half of the teachers that we know of are buying their own stuff for the classroom.
Yeah.
For the kids. Disgusting. They're going out of their way to buy shit for their kids because the school don't have the funding. So maybe start looking at the funding issue for the school and not so much at what the parents are having to do or the teachers are having to do to make ends meet in their own lives.
Yeah, the amount of time and energy that they're putting into teaching these kids and then they're having to put in their own money and they're still not even making ends meet.
Yeah.
Of course people are having to do things on the side. And when there's not much left to do on the side, you have to do other things.
And if you aren't going to put funding into that school, then who's going to be teaching your children Donald Trump? Nice. As in, I mean,
No. So Paul is with the scientist and he confirms that there were trace amounts of antifreeze in the casserole. Paul asks what would happen if he continued to eat the food, and the scientist tells him the consequences of eating small amounts of antifreeze over time and the slow death that this would lead to.
Yeah.
I'm amazed that antifreeze doesn't have a taste. But then again, it is Susan's cooking.
It's just small doses as well, so
yeah,
it's cooked into it. Yeah.
Back to Susan. Susan has Felicia over and is bitching about the snotty mums to her, which she clearly doesn't care about.
Felicia does not give a shit about Susan's sad little life.
Like, she changes the subject to Paul almost instantly, like literally as soon as she can.
We say instantly. For us, it's instant. God knows how long Susan's been wanging on without the camera there.
Yeah, but Felicia is having to like really act her ass off and be like, oh.
She could be throwing up in a new handbag any minute.
Yeah, yeah. Susan talks about Paul's symptoms, but she tells her not to worry, as when she was a nurse, she always saw that the best cure for stress was rest and good food, which is such a mum thing to say.
It really is a mum thing to say.
When Susan turns her back, Felicia then sneakily adds her poison to the cookie batter that Susan is making.
Quite a bit as well. She pours a little bit in.
Yeah, and then notices, I thought it was meant to be a small amount.
Yeah, then she notices that Susan hasn't turned around yet. She's like, pours in the rest.
Yeah, she's literally like, oh, what the hell?
Oh, what the hell? But surely Susan would notice like a puddle of liquid on top of the dough she's made.
Well, Susan doesn't notice a lot of things.
Because it's dough, so, you know, it won't, the liquid won't just absorb into it, like, straight away. You're not just going to pour it in. It's not a sponge.
Mm.
You'd need to start mixing again. And so surely, as Susan has just mixed it and made the dough, she'd notice a puddle of clear liquid on top of it. Yeah. But, oh well, whatever, semantics and all that.
But Felicia just makes me laugh. She's just so funny when she's doing these sneaky things.
Yeah.
Susan shows up to the open house event, streamers and all, and the snotty PTA mom notices that Susan has a tub of her homemade cookies in the car. She thinks that Susan brought them for the open house thing and calls her a lifesaver as the other mums flaked out on bringing anything. So Susan goes along with it. And reminder, these cookies are full of antifreeze.
Yeah, they're poison. They're poison cookies.
The PTA mom then says that maybe she misjudged Susan and that they should find some time to sit down with the principal at some point.
Yeah.
Later, she goes over to Paul's place with lasagna, and he tells her that she should join him to eat it. She says that she can't, but he tells her to sit down and insists that she has some.
It's one of those scenes where Susan's just innocently saying no because she genuinely has no other reason to say yes. Like, she's like, oh no, I've got things to do. No, thank you. So her no is innocent, but Paul is so adamant that the lasagna she's made is poisoned.
Yeah.
Even though in this instance it won't be because the plan with Felicia was never to make lasagna. But he's so adamant that it's poisoned that the fact that Susan's now saying no means that it's solidifying his thought.
Yeah, she's like, no, I've got to go. And he's like, liar. Susan's clearly confused, and so Paul says that she should just stab him, and then accuses her of poisoning his food.
This scene annoys me so much, and it is up there with that fucking airport scene with Catherine and Mike and that bitchy-ass woman that didn't pass that message on to Catherine properly.
Which part annoys you?
The part where, instead of Susan explaining the situation, she just goes, oh my god, and runs away from Paul. And I'm like, all it took was a quick explanation, Susan.
Well, there's no time.
There is absolutely time.
There's no time. The kids are going to be in this poison any minute.
The kids aren't eating them. It's a parental open house. The kids aren't eating.
More confusion from Susan until she then remembers who she's been around when making all of the food and rushes to the school to stop the cookies from being given out. But all the cookies are already out. So Susan decides to rush around and steal everyone's cookies.
Again.
It's really sad because the principal literally goes up to her to say that the parents all love her now.
Yeah.
Like, it's so sad.
But again, all Susan needed to do was say to Paul, Felicia was cooking with me, and then run off. That's all she needed. That one extra line, and that would have helped add some context to the situation. And instead, she doesn't say anything and runs off. Bitch, a single cookie will not kill a person, okay? That's all that dough mixed in. And then when Susan gets to the school and she's like, where are my cookies? Have you put them out yet? it actually turns out that those cookies have been mixed in with other batches of cookies that other people have made. So actually, the likelihood of a person dying from a poison cookie is very, very small. And it might have just made them a little bit sick and given them a bit of a stomach ache, which you could have just let happen. You could have let happen. Nobody would have been none the wiser, and you would have got your damn job back, and you would have actually still not been arrested.
What's wrong with you? No, she can't do that. You can't just let these people eat these cookies. Are you crazy?
Yes, you can, because it's one cookie.
No.
It's like one or two cookies. It is not going to kill a person. You've seen how much antifreeze Paul has inhaled and he's still fine.
What if any of these people are already being antifreezed and this cookie is the thing that sends them over the edge?
Well, then we blame the person that was originally antifreezing them. Susan made this a much bigger issue than it actually has to be because she was panicking. Obviously, it's for the sake of TV, so we're going to go with that. But in real life, a person like this, this is so overdramatic. It really aggravates me.
No, you're insane.
Her behavior here literally ruins any chance she has of joining the school again.
You're crazy. So,
yeah. I can't be the only person that is thinking this. I cannot be the only person.
You don't let
this.
People eat poison cookies.
They're barely poisoned. It's poison with a small p.
Oh my god.
You saw how much antifreeze Felicia put into that dough, and when you...
It may have a small p, but there's still an exclamation mark.
When you batch up those cookies, like the amount of antifreeze in each individual cookie would be tiny. Probably wouldn't even show up on an actual test.
Oh my god. She then flips up all of the cookie plates on the table, but there are still more cookies everywhere. There's cookies everywhere.
There are literally fucking
because
cookies.
She doesn't know who's a who's.
Exactly, because they've got mixed up.
Sorry, but why is there nothing but cookies on offer?
I don't know. I thought the other woman said that she had Mother's Flake on her. Maybe the only mothers that didn't flake were the cookie mums.
Like, the only thing you have to eat is cookies.
What the actual fuck?
That's got to be for comedic effect. Just the amount of cookies everywhere.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she flips up all the cookie plates on the table, but there are still cookies everywhere. She gets on stage and tries to convince everyone not to eat the cookies due to poison. And then Paul walks in with the police, points Susan out, and she gets arrested.
Susan should have kept her damn mouth shut.
Yeah, but also, Paul, can you not read the room? Did you not just see her storm out of the house in panic? And
yeah,
then
probably
did you not just...
Because in his mind, probably because she's been caught out and she's trying to run away.
Paul's insane. Like, I was just like, it's so obvious that she hasn't done this. Look at the reaction.
Yeah, of course it's obvious she hasn't done this. But at the same time, Susan didn't say anything to say she hadn't done this. Susan just went, oh my god, and ran. Whereas actually, if before she ran, she just said, Felicia was cooking with me, Paul would have taken that and probably understood.
There's no time. There's poison cookies. Just when I go, who was Felicia?
There is absolutely time because you could have left those damn poison cookies. That would not have killed a person. That may have given them a mild stomach ache.
Can we please stop talking about the poison cookies?
You could have left those damn poison cookies and Susan should have kept her damn mouth shut. She'd have kept her job. But instead, she didn't. She got up on that podium and said, don't eat the cookies. They're poison.
Stop talking about the poison cookies. We don't agree on it.
And the woman behind Susan...
You sound crazy.
The woman behind Susan was gagged when the police came up on that stage and took her away.
She probably carried on eating a cookie right after, like, oh.
Yeah, I know, because when she said, don't eat the cookies, they're poison, everyone laughed.
Yeah.
Everyone was like, haha, Susan's back. Classic Susan.
Yeah. Judgy, hypocritical bitches, all these people. I hate them. Anyway, I thought I would end the episode there because it felt like the biggest oof ending moment of the episode.
Yeah,
for me.
It was
like, holy shit, Susan just got arrested.
Yeah.
And thus ends the episode.
Mm.
So let's move on to our next part of the episode, where Joel is going to give us the gayest and the straightest moments of the episode, starting with the gayest moment. So over to you.
My award for gayest moment. It was a tough one because I do have two very good choices. But I am going to give this to Lee because he does give proper gay uncle vibes in this episode.
What, as in like gay childless uncle vibes?
Gay uncle vibes, right? Like he tells Gabby that he'll like help Juanita understand and then he scares her even more. And then he scares her again when they're camping.
Right. It's almost like if someone was like, oh, she's really scared of the dark, you'd be like, why be scared of the dark? You're much more likely to be bitten by a snake. Like,
yeah.
That kind of vibe.
So he gave real gay uncle vibes in this episode.
Yeah, he really did. He did. I enjoyed him.
Yeah.
And what do you have for the straightest moment?
My award for straightest moment. don't really have one.
Then why did you make me play The Sting?
Because I like The Sting. No, I don't really have one. I was kind of hoping that during that time I would be able to think of one because I was racking my brain. But no one really did anything massively straight, in my opinion, in this episode.
You say that every time you don't have one, and then you say, I'll think of one in the time that he, like, clicks on it, and then you don't.
Sometimes I do, actually. Sometimes I do think of one.
Oh.
But this time, I couldn't think of one. I don't really think anybody did anything massively straight. I mean, Tom did call Lynette a raging bitch, but that's not necessarily straight. That's just factual.
I mean, there is, like, what was it called? Sensible Parenting Magazine? There is that.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily straight.
Well, the straights are the ones that make the babies.
That is true.
And then they're the ones that are, like, so conservative about parenting.
But that's implying that gay people aren't necessarily responsible parents.
Well, I don't think that they're going to be in this particular type of responsible magazine.
No, oh, that is true, we're not. So, yeah, okay, good point. Do you know what? Straightest Moment goes to Responsible Parent Magazine.
I do wonder if any of them have had a discussing the gay agenda with your kids.
Yeah, probably. So, yeah, there we go. Bravo to Lee and the Responsible Parent Magazine.
Which Lynette is aware of, which concerns me.
She is aware of. She knows of its existence, and she clearly reads it.
Did she? Yeah.
So those are my awards, and now we move on to B's awards for Best and Worst Parent. So who do you have for the best parent?
My award for...
Best Parent of the Episode.
In my notes, I gave it to Susan for not poisoning all of the mums. But I actually retract that, and from recording this episode, I've decided to give it to Lee for his moment with Juanita because I thought it was fun and cute.
Okay, fine.
I liked it. He was like, you don't need to be scared. No thing is scary just because it looks scary. He made fun of a scary moment for her.
Gabby had a nice moment with Juanita as well.
Gabby was a fucking idiot.
She had a nice moment with Juanita in the tent where she was like, I'm scared. And Gabby was like, it's okay to be scared and it's fun as well, but you can't let it come from inside your own head. Like, you have to control your fear.
Which is all well and good when you're the one scaring her.
Yeah. True.
Showing her the movies.
Yeah, but Lee was the one scaring her as well.
Yeah, but that was funny. So.
So who do you have for the worst parent?
My award for?
Worst parent of the episode.
Gabby. Again, it goes to Gabby.
Yeah, no.
For watching a horror film with Juanita, who clearly isn't ready for films like that. She doesn't have that kind of...
I wouldn't even call it a horror film that they were watching. It sounded more like a slasher film.
Slasher films are horror films.
Yeah.
It's a subgenre of horror.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it goes to Gabby. And the proof was in the pudding.
Yeah.
So, that was the end of Season 7, Episode 21, Then I've Really Got Scared. If anyone has any questions, queries, comments and theories, where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at Boyfriends Review, and you can find us on TikTok, which is exactly the same, at Boyfriends Review, and you can find us on Reddit at Boyfriends Review Pod.
And we also have email, which is boyfriendsreview@outlook.com. All of the artwork is done by our friend Louis, who you can find on Instagram at DocRedMonkDesign, and there is a link to his Etsy page where he does commissions. Join us next time when we'll be back in your earholes with Season 7, Episode 22, and lots of security.
Ooh.
So, see you then, guys.
Bye, guys.
Bye.